Sexton trying to get loose. He'll fire.
He knocks it down.
Vaccaro slammed it home. Garland upstairs. Oh! Sexton inside. Oh. A thunderous dunk.
And Allen blocked the shot at the rim.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Cavs Media family. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Zoom. 500,000 businesses connect using Zoom, a single platform for phone, chat, workspaces, events, apps, and video. Zoom enables real-time collaboration for teams around the globe. Zoom, how the world connects. And connecting with me now live via Zoom is my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Happy Easter to those who celebrate. And I got a case of the sad still. You know, if we're really calling a spade, I mean, it stinks to kind of have the season end the way it did and, you know, losing kind of the extended stretch of good vibes that kind of got dashed by injuries, by poor play. But, you know, I don't know if I'm all the way back to being able to see it big picture just yet, because I'm still just a little bit sad, to be honest. But I think this podcast actually is going to help me go a long way towards, you know, appreciating the year that was for the Cleveland Cavaliers, because it's over, buddy.
You know what? I think that's a completely reasonable way to feel. For me, something I'm learning about myself is I think I go through the emotions more before something occurs. Once something has happened, I'm kind of like at the point where, you know, I'm just going to analyze it. What's the next steps to move forward? I was actually feeling pretty calm after that game, but it obviously was crushing in the moment. I mean, in a lot of ways, it felt like the play-in game against the Atlanta Hawks mimicked the season, where it started off with pure euphoria. Everything's clicking. You're feeling confident. The gambles that you're making seem to be working out. You have a starting five that's playing their first minutes together of the season, and it was working. And then it started to slip a little bit. There's reasons to still be encouraged, feeling like, hey, you know what? We can still pull this out. And then just towards the end, you feel that sense of not like this, not this way. Just it was there. It was in their grasp. And ultimately, they weren't able to pull it off. So in a lot of ways, it did feel like it mimicked the season. I was sitting there grumpy that other teams in the play-in, especially when you look at the Western Conference, they play teams with losing records, and we get much more battle-tested teams against the Brooklyn Nets and Atlanta Hawks. But ultimately, like I thought overall, they showed pretty well against the Hawks. It was obviously frustrating to blow it in the way that they did. But I kind of feel a sense of gratitude. Like, I didn't want the season to end this way. I know it ended up basically where we were hoping it would end up at the start of the season, but obviously the expectations had changed. But when you look at it, when you look at the way that this team competed, the amount of times this year that they were down and they battled back into it, like I just kind of feel like a sense of gratitude for just what this season ultimately was.
I think that is the correct way to feel. Not that, you know, we're in the business of telling people how to feel, but I think that's the evolved, healthy way to feel. I think that we learned a lot. I mean, the reason we wanted to see this team in these kind of high-stakes situations is because you do learn a lot. And I do wonder how much harder it is for them now, though, that they have to make what, you know, like I was thinking about this in the lead up to the podcast from the perspective of, I have all these actionable things that I want to do right now, because we saw postseason basketball. We saw what worked and what didn't, who played well and who didn't. And I think one thing that is a little dangerous and that the Cavs front office is going to have to talk themselves through, just like I have to talk myself through, is it's still a 2-game sample.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we got a full series to really think through changes and decisions. So, like, you know, like I'm sure we're going to talk about them, but Isaac has two rough games.
Mm-hmm.
Is it proof he's not a playoff player and someone who's not ready? I don't know.
That's the perils of single elimination basketball, right?
It's tough, like, tough.
look at the start of the playoffs. Memphis losing game one against Minnesota. Like, typically you'd think, okay, we now can make some adjustments for the next game in the series, but you don't have that opportunity, right? And even looking at the four finals runs, look at Kyrie game one and two against Golden State in 2016 and frankly 2017 as well. Look at the Cavs dropping game one against the Chicago Bulls in 2015 and kind of the ebbs and flows of that series. I mean, the real lesson and the real takeaway is you want to avoid the play-in tournament and you don't want to be in this position. But I do think that it's important to note that when you are in these single game scenarios, anything can happen. And I think there were some aspects of the game that were uncharacteristic. You look at Garland on Friday, or Garland against Brooklyn, I should say, and he started off a little hesitant, and then he gained confidence as the game went on. He was playing with pace, with flow, with rhythm. And then against the Atlanta Hawks, I thought he had a great first half and just had some shots that didn't fall.
Yeah, but then I saw his box score in the first half and was surprised it was so ugly.
Yeah.
Because I agree with you. I thought he played a good game in the first half.
And then it was the opposite as the Brooklyn game, where in the second half, I felt like he really slowed down the pace. He wasn't as confident. He wasn't playing as freely. And just a totally different second half compared to what he did in that high-pressure scenario against Brooklyn. And I felt that change of pace where they were really slowing it down allowed Atlanta to get set up on defense. And it caused the Cavs to play just a little bit more tight, right? Like you felt like they felt the game slipping the same way that we did. And those are the types of things that you want to learn in an extended playoff series of, okay, how do you adjust from that? How do you learn from that experience? But the unfortunate thing about being in the play-in scenario is you don't get that opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, as we've said from Jump Street, play-in detractors say that they don't like that 20 teams make the playoffs or have a shot to make the postseason. I think 12 teams do. Mm-hmm. I think that you look at a team like the Clippers, who I think probably were a top eight team all season in the West, and they don't get mm-hmm. to go either, you know? And like, so.
Well, in the West, it's so much more clear because both of the 9-10 teams had losing records, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, but then, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because it's a one game playoff, and that's why you avoid it at all costs. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, the Clippers, maybe more than the Cavs, should be insanely proud of the season they had, playing without Kawhi or Paul George for the vast majority of the year. But mm-hmm. like, again, there is a certain, you know, pain there, and I think that avoiding that pain at all costs is going to be really, really important moving forward. And you know, I think the Cavs, I hope that the Cavs kind of know that, like, hey, they kind of are going to have a target on their back next year.
Mm-hmm.
Because there have been teams that play really well that fall apart down the stretch and don't find their mojo again. So mm-hmm. It was a team that I thought their post game stuff always felt appropriate. They were sad, but you know, knew they had a special year. But like, I really do feel like the pressure is on, and that's another reason I'm sad, Justin. If I can be really honest, is I feel like we kind of got robbed of our good vibes year a little bit. Like, because next year, I'm already really, really, I'm really hoping to see this team prove to me that they are indeed as good as they looked for the first 60 games.
I think that's pretty fair. I mean, part of the reason why I feel gratitude with this season, even though I agree where you kind of get deprived of the good vibes finish where you're just playing with house money and whatnot. I feel gratitude because you came into the season looking for a player that could be the guy. That's why there were conversations about should the Cavs make a roll the dice and go after someone like Ben Simmons. Like, we need to bring in someone, even if they have flaws, because you just need to get that kind of apex guy. And I don't feel that anymore. I feel very confident with Darius Garland as the point guard. I think obviously you have some limitations if your quote unquote best player is a guard, but at the same time, there doesn't appear to be a ceiling for Evan Mobley. And having two guys that broke out in the way that they did is something that I find incredibly encouraging. Jared Allen playing as well as he did is obviously very encouraging. So I just feel like the starting, the foundation is so much more solid than it was before. And if we're comparing it to like a new house, I feel like the foundation has been poured, the walls are up, the plumbing's done, the electrical's done, and we got to start furnishing. We got to start making some tweaks to how it's going to look on the inside. But the bones, the everything that you is more essential is in place right now for the Cavs. And I think that that's a really good position to be in.
The bones are good. And I kind of want to ask you this. This Cavs team relied on a couple key vets in Kevin Love and Ricky Rubio, then Rajon Rondo. The rest of this team is full of 22-year-olds. I'm wondering, just watching these two play-in games, watching them feel like, okay, it's not going to be an Isaac game, 13 minutes, 14 minutes. Okay, Jetty, no, we can't trust you. You're out altogether. Is there a degree, do you have an appetite to try to find more vets that still have some juice? Kind of some in their prime, late prime vets to supplement this roster, because the reality is they are just so dependent on the kids to break out right now among the role players. And I think we kind of learned that JB didn't have a lot of options when the kids weren't quite ready.
Yeah, I'll say this. I think there's an appeal to that. Like, even if you could bring in someone like Joe Ingles, they'll probably not be ready for the start of the year, but you know, could, in theory, once he comes back, give them a boost. I think there's advantages of that. I don't feel, maybe this is the best way to frame it, I don't feel like they need to be a finished product from a roster standpoint next season. I think it's okay to maybe not necessarily bring in like a high level backup point guard. I think you need to bring in a backup point guard that you feel comfortable playing, but I don't think it necessarily even needs to be an elite playmaker.
Is that
like
how
old
Neto's music, Justin?
That it absolutely is. It is Neto time, baby. DeLon Wright, Goran Dragic.
God, like, how good was DeLon Wright in that freaking game, by the way?
He was
a
very
menace.
Good.
A menace.
And I think Garland slowing the pace down was kind of playing into his hands there. But I think you'd look for that caliber, because I want to leave some room for growth in terms of responsibility on the team. I want, even if it costs you a win or two over the course of a season, I want Evan Mobley to be empowered as a playmaker. I want to see other guys try to grow into those roles. So I don't want it to be a situation where all the gaps are filled by players that can 100% handle that responsibility. Guys that can make that role easier for Mobley, I think that that's attractive. Guys that, you know, wings that provide three-point shooting and defense, but maybe not playmaking. Like that's the type of addition I'd like to see. But I do think it's important that you leave that room for internal growth and for the guys that you have on the team to have that space to grow into those roles.
So I think like what it is I'm looking at these playoff rosters right now, and like this is kind of our wheelhouse, Justin, looking at teams that are ahead of the Cavs and figuring out what we can steal. And you look at a team like the Bucks. They have Grayson Allen. They have Pat Connaughton. These role players who you can kind of trust in a foxhole. They aren't someone who's got those archetypes aren't going to stunt the growth of your stars. And by the way, I mean, and in fairness, some of that does come internal. Pat Connaughton was not a foxhole guy 2 years ago, and now he is. But like you look at guys like that, you look at a guy like Max Strus for the Heat.
Yeah.
You look at freaking DeLon Wright. We just mentioned him. The plethora of playable wings that most of these teams have, and you just kind of look and realize the Cavs don't have a lot of those types of role players, especially on the wing. And like, I wouldn't be opposed to trying to find a way towards that. Someone who you can count on a little bit more than the kids. Because, like, depending on Jetty or Dylan Windler or Isaac Okoro, to be able to play heavy wing minutes in a winning environment, in a, you know, in playoff basketball is okay, but not having any alternative to those three, I think we saw some holes in that plan.
Yeah, I think what I would like to see is, if you're going to adjust the personnel, bringing guys that allow you to change up your style. Like, I think we had a lot of guys that can functionally fill in the same role. Like, Dean Wade could fill in what Laurie was doing. Lamar can fill in a little bit of what Isaac's doing. But there wasn't really the personnel to change up the style of what the Cavs do a whole lot. Like, I think we stripped it down a little bit after Ricky Rubio and Sexton went out. And maybe having Colin Sexton changes what you're able to do a little bit offensively. But I do think, in terms of having the wings to maybe play a different defensive scheme, like Trae Young was flustered by what the Cavs were doing in the first half, as sometimes they would switch, sometimes they wouldn't. They were giving him a lot of different looks. But then he got a little bit more comfortable, and they were giving up the switch a little easier than you'd like to see. He got on Lauri Markkanen a bunch and was able to hit some tough shots. Like, he was still shooting from 40 feet out, but he was more in his rhythm. And I think when you look at the playoffs, you look at these last couple games, having the personnel to make those type of adjustments, to make guys uncomfortable, and just having the wing depth, I think is definitely a hole that you can see, and an opportunity to really improve the supporting cast around guys that we feel very confident in.
Yeah. I also want to talk about this. A lot of heat coming JB's way after that Hawks game. And I think some of it, and obviously, you know, blanket chase down disclaimer, we're not coaches. We don't know exactly what the game plan was. And, you know, it's really hard to evaluate coaching, blah, 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 blah. But with that said, I think some of it was earned. I think that McMillan out-adjusted him. I think JB won the pregame coaching battle and then lost.
Came in with a better game plan, yeah, I agree.
And lost the in-game coaching battle. Because Trey figured out that, okay, so they're actually just going to switch every time. It wasn't like, you could tell he was in that first half. His wheels were turning, which is what a defensive game plan should do to a star, is make them think. His wheels were turning. Well, where am I supposed to get mine? Because I'm working to get all this. I'm working so hard to get a switch, and you know the spacing's really not there for me right now, and I'm just taking a lot of step back 15 footers. But by the second half, he realized, okay, if they're actually going to guard me hard, I'm going to do like the on ball equivalent of slipping the screen by just pulling from three before the switch occurs, when neither person is guarding me yet. I'm going to split and attack the switch. We're gonna play smaller, and I'm gonna get way easier rim access, especially when Kevin Love's in the game. So like, I think he figured it out, and the Cavs needed to change their strat. Whether it is just a hard hedge and going back to the shell defense, that, by the way, they can also play really well with their three bigs on the floor. That's another thing that disappointed me, because it's not like this was their defense all year, where they switch everything no matter what. Normally, they would really only switch that kind of stuff if it was a Markkanen Mobley action or something like that. They did not switch this aggressively, or just this, I mean, frankly, passively, where they were giving up soft switches. I think they could have done that. Before I talk about what I don't like about what JB, or what I'm fine with what JB did, what are your thoughts on how on his strategy in the game?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they were giving up the switches in the second half a little too easily. I don't think they were switching the whole first half. I do think that they changed it up a little bit. But in the second half in particular, I thought they're giving it up a little too easily. I think the execution wasn't great either. Like, you could tell that there was miscommunication on the court and the guys were talking to one another. So that was definitely an issue. And ironically, like, Capella taking himself out of the game with that flagrant foul that wasn't called as a flagrant, that really changed the game, because I flat out think the Hawks are better with Okongwu. Like they were better with Okongwu all season. The Hawks went smaller after that, and the Cavs, all of a sudden the game plan that they had coming into the game wasn't as effective because the Hawks were more mobile. They were smaller, they were faster.
Switch here.
And Okongwu played
some great defense. I cannot believe. I mean, you can look at the Karis lob that got busted up that basically ended the game and say, okay, he could have put a little bit more ass on that one and gotten it to Jared a little faster with a little less float. But man, I how did he get to that? That was a hell of a defensive play.
Yeah, and I think the Cavs also played into their hands by the guards, Garland and LeVert in particular, slowing it down. They really let the Hawks set up. And when they are now playing more versatile, quicker personnel defensively with DeLon Wright and Okongwu, you don't want to do that. You don't want to have them set up. So I think they played into their hands a little bit. I think that was some inexperience on the behalf of Darius Garland. And that's the type of stuff that you can learn from, right? Like, you need to have the confidence to play at your pace, to dictate the terms of engagement. And the Cavs did that in the first half, and they didn't in the second half. And I think that aspect is on the players. But I do agree. I think that there is opportunity to grow for growth for JB Bickerstaff as well. And, I mean, the interesting thing is, I think coaches and players, there's a real symbiotic relationship. When you have the same group of guys for a while, you understand the ebbs and flows of their play. When you need to call a timeout, when you can let a guy go through a rough stretch, who you can trust, what combinations work really well. And I think that was something that the Cavs got deprived of down the stretch, where because there's so many guys in and out of the lineup, you don't get a real feel for the ebbs and flows of your roster. And that makes it so much more difficult to know when to what buttons to push, what adjustments to make, when to call the timeout, when to let them play through that stuff. And as I said before, like, they're starting five. I thought it was a really smart adjustment. It made it so that there was nowhere to hide Trae Young. But from a tactical standpoint, I also didn't love the fact that Rondo and Okoro were out there together. Like, I thought you could have had both of them in the rotation, but without them playing together, like staggering them a little bit better. And those are adjustments that if this was a 7-game series against the Hawks, I would expect them to make. But in this 1-game scenario where a mistake like that can be exposed, it really ended up contributing to the loss.
I want to push back on this. This was actually, you set me up beautifully. So unless you very, very, very strongly feel like Jetty Osman or Lamar Stevens or Dylan Windler should have gotten run in this game, it's really, really hard to do this because the reality is Darius is starting, Karis is starting. They played 83 combined minutes. So it's not like there was a lot of time to play Jenga here with them, you know, like, and I think that what kind of doomed them and what I don't know what a good way around it is. Is okay, so you bring in Rondo and Darius to play some minutes together early on, and Rondo so very clearly doesn't have it. You know, which happens, by the way. We've talked about this a billion times. He's one of the only reasons we were in the Nets game. So, like, miss me with the idea that there's no way he should have been playing Rondo, which I saw on Twitter, which is just, you know.
Oh, no, Rondo should have played in that game.
So, Rondo clearly didn't have it, which happens when you're 1,000 years old. Sorry, Rajon. and it kind of backs you into a weird corner because you've already your first rotation was to bring Rondo in and play those double point guard minutes, but he doesn't have it, so now you have to keep him in because eventually you got to get Darius a little blow. And I believe LeVert played some of those early minutes as well, so like, at some point you're gonna back yourself into that. I mean, again, those dudes only played 37 combined minutes, but I think it is much more a byproduct of the lack of options JB had that he trusted, that he had to, you know, like, just the way the rotation plays out. I think it was challenging to avoid playing them because inherently playing this short of a rotation, especially such a short rotation with Kevin Love only being able to play 10 minutes because of the fact that, frankly, the Hawks were really, really going after him. It means Laurie has to spend a lot more time at the four, which means Karis has to slide more up at the three. and you're just kind of running out of room to avoid certain pairings. So as much as I wanted, as much as while I was watching, I was like, this isn't going to work. I just don't, I feel like it, you really have to look at the rotational math and the minute math to see it was probably going to have to happen at one point or another, unless Darius played 48.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think when you factor in like Love playing 10 minutes, Jetty not playing at all.
I would have played Jetty, by the way. That is one of my only adjustments. I thought the way the Hawks were defending in the second half, I would have played Jetty out there with Rondo and said, I can't score on them right now with this Rondo Okoro pairing. Jetty might kill me, but I'm dying anyway right now.
Yeah.
So that is the one thing I would have done. But clearly JB didn't trust him in this game. And like, you know, you have to make those decisions as a coach. So like, while I think JB took some lumps in this game, I want to make sure people know which lumps he should be taking and which lumps he shouldn't. That's all I want to say.
Right. And I think smarter people understand that coaches aren't a static commodity. They have good and bad games. They have good and bad plays, just like players. And they can learn from experiences the same way players do. Right. So I mean, JB did a fantastic job overall this season. There's no denying that.
I actually left this mini postseason more confident in JB's chops as a game planner. I thought they did some really cool stuff against Brooklyn. It didn't work because KD and Kyrie went absolutely Nova.
Yeah.
And I thought they did some really cool stuff against Atlanta that was not in their base defensive sets. I think to some extent I would have been a little disappointed if play-in starts and they're just basically the same team. I think they did some interesting junky stuff that says, they had an opinion on this game on a certain thing they wanted to do. So I actually left impressed. It just didn't play out in their favor in the end in the win-loss column.
I agree. And we said this last year as well, right? That there was a lot of criticism that there wasn't the offensive imagination and whatnot. And then when you came into this year with Ricky Rubio and better personnel, all of a sudden the offense was much more evolved, right? So I do think that with more options from a personnel standpoint, from the supporting cast, you're going to be able to make better analysis of the strengths and weaknesses of the team, where JB can improve, where the players can improve through internal growth or offseason moves. But I do think you look at Love playing 10 minutes and Jetty not playing at all. And I agree. I think I might have given Jetty a look. But I think that needs to go into your offseason math. When both of them are essentially expiring contracts and you didn't feel fully comfortable giving them minutes in this spot. Now, Kevin Love, he can play in a Cavs jersey for as long as he wants, in my opinion. But I do think that you need to evaluate the opportunities and say, okay, if there's going to be nights where we don't necessarily trust Love to give him 20 minutes, especially in a situation where Allen clearly isn't 100% and playing with one hand. And
definitely playing with one hand.
Oh, yeah. He was tentative to go up.
He had three rebounds and one block in his 36 minutes. And he was working hard.
Yeah, I thought he actually had a positive impact on the game, even though he was very, 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 very limited, and that was clear to see. But like that needs to go in your math of, okay, if there's going to be some nights where we can't play Love as much and we are keeping him on the roster, then what does that mean from the rest of the spots in the rotation? Do you want to bring in a guy that is more matchup specific for those nights where you don't feel as confident playing Love?
Back
what does that mean?
Up center, Justin. That is the move. Mobile backup five. I'm telling you. If we don't start next season with a backup five that I trust, I'm going to be pretty disappointed, to be honest, because that solves your problem. It really does. If you can say, Kevin, this isn't a good matchup for Kevin, or Kevin doesn't quite have it physically tonight, because he's, by the way, also getting old. Some nights he was amazing against Brooklyn, kept us in the game. Almost got us over the finish line there. And then, you know, the second he was out against the Hawks in space, you went, he is negating the one advantage we have.
Yep.
So
yep,
like, I agree. And that's playoff basketball, man, especially with a guy at his age with his injury history. So like, you can insulate yourself so much by adding some athleticism on the backup front line. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but man, no, I want a good backup five this summer.
No, I agree with you. And I think you need to do the math on Jetty as well, right? Like where you feel confident playing him, where you don't, and are upgrades available. So that is going to need to be something that they consider. I do think Lauri Markkanen was fantastic against the Hawks. Obviously had that turnover at the end that was a bit of a heartbreaker. You know, pressure
JB,
moments.
That, there's another JB mistake. That should have been a timeout called from the bench. He was right in front of
his
bench.
I disagree. I don't think that should have been a timeout. I think you should have just gone. Like, don't let the Hawks set up. Like, get it to Garland and let's go cook. But
I think this is a KYP situation. High pressure. Every bodies are scrambling, just reset. But ultimately, I mean, it's a mistake, but I think you're right. I thought Lowry had a freaking awesome game. And by the way, I thought he was better against Brooklyn than anyone in acted he was. Mm-hmm.
Brooklyn was hit or miss.
He did contribute. And then against Atlanta, he was awesome. I thought he played as good of defense as you could have expected. And I think, like, if you are upset with Lauri Markkanen about how the defense in the second half went, like, again, you just need to redirect your attention to, you know, the strategy and the fact that he was being asked to do something. Guarding Trey in space is very different than guarding Trey with Jarrett and Evan in the paint protecting you on the back end. And I thought he did everything you could have asked him to do. I mean, that crazy tip in that he made. Yeah. The 3-point shooting.
His defense on Hunter, I thought, was very good for the majority of the game.
I thought he really, really, and by the way, you could tell in the post game that he was really freaking disappointed. He didn't get to the postseason for the first time in his career. So you cannot ask more of Lowry. And frankly, like, you needed to see that, because if he had another bad game, you could conceivably make the argument that the Cavs can only really feel good about three of their players. With Colin coming off injury, Lowry had struggled, because Okoro had struggled, and then, you know, Love is getting older, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, maybe this core, and, you know, LeVert obviously has been an up and down experience, and now you can go, okay, we can create an environment where role players can shine, because that is what Lowry is a highly paid, is a pretty well paid role player.
And plays well off of your core guys that you feel good about, which is really important.
Which is what they got to find.
Yeah, and I think from a team building standpoint, the fact that he can play four or three, I think, gives you some positional versatility. The fact that Garland can play with point guards or shooting guards or multiple small forwards and like less spacing than he even had last season. Like, I think that's a positive. The biggest positive to me is the 20-year-old that cannot be rushed, cannot be rattled, and was great throughout the play-in, Mobley. I cannot believe how good he is at basketball. Like, I thought he made some brilliant plays. I thought in the second half, when everyone was kind of panicking a little bit, he showed a lot of composure. I'm in awe of what Evan Mobley can do on a basketball court.
He was so very good, and it's so very clear he is a power forward. Watching him move back to the four, defensively, offensively, the fact that he opens the Atlanta game stroking a three from the corner confidently, it was just really encouraging. He made some truly elite passes. Both in the
it's
post
so easy
and
to
off
see
the
how
dribble.
Scalable his offense is going to be. Like the two-man offensive game with Garland and Mobley, and especially here's the fun part. Adding Sexton as the off-ball finisher and shooter and scorer that he is. Like, what you can do with those three in particular is so fun to think about.
Yeah, he was genuinely so in control. I still think you saw the warts that are there. The three-point jumper isn't all the way there yet. Actually, it's bad right now. The defensive rebounding still is not where you need it to be. I mean, only had five defensive boards. But I mean, just ultimately he looks so freaking polished. Seeing the high low with him and Jarrett again, it warmed my soul. That is, as much as their defense is foundational for this team, the high low between them is foundational. and they need, and there's still room for it to get better. The Hawks took it away in the second half. Darius went to find Evan, and they bodied him on the short roll. They were hitting him hard, and he was off balance and was not able to make the impactful plays we know he can on the short roll when he gets space. But, you know, again, that's this is learning tape for him.
I think there's a lot of that, both for he and Garland. Like, I think there's a ton that you can look at in this game, and there's things you can learn. Like, I think it's such a missed opportunity to not make the playoffs and not get the chance to game plan for the same team and see the game-to-game adjustments. But at the end of the day, like, this is the worst-case scenario of how this end of the season could happen for the Cavs, and it created a unique opportunity where now they have a lottery pick. For a team that is too good to have a lottery pick. And personally, I would have preferred to make the playoffs. I have confidence in Kobe to find value in the margins, to get in on three-team deals, to add Ricky Rubio, even though the free agent point guard market is bad. Like, I have so much confidence in this team that I don't think they necessarily needed to have this pick. But the fact that they do, I do think it opens some doors and creates some really unique opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but be a grumpy Scrooge about the lottery pick thing. It will be pick 14, almost certainly. It's the very, very end of the lottery. This is not a 6 or an 8. This will be 14 with a 2.4% chance that it'll be top 4.
All right, I think 3.7.
Whatever it is, very, very, very low percentage relative to the most likely outcome, which is that it will be 14. So you are not likely getting a cream of the crop prospect there. Doesn't mean you can't get a really good player, even a starter, or even like a fringe all-star. I mean, the Grizzlies got Desmond Bane at the end of the first round. So you can find it, but your odds go lower. So
Cam Johnson, Mikal Bridges, like there are
players.
Even Zaire has helped Memphis a lot. Brandon Clark in the 20s. Like, there are examples of that. And like, we'll get into this more in the offseason, obviously. My preference would be to put it on the block and see if an established player is available. But at the same time, like, you look at the draft, and I've already gone into a little bit of my draft scouting over the weekend.
Everyone loves Igbaji, or however you say it.
Exactly. Like, there are options available that fill the need, and maybe it's not a guy that's going to be a catalyst, but the Cavs don't necessarily need that. Like, you have enough guys that can do that. I think there's going to be options that can fill a role, so there is no bad scenario there. But I agree with what you're saying. Like, if you're adding another kid, odds are there's going to be a learning curve, even if they had 4 years in college. So that is going to be something that they'll need to weigh. The other things they'll need to weigh is obviously the contract situations, with both Caris LeVert being contract extension eligible and Colin Sexton.
How about two dudes asking how they can stay in Cleveland?
I think that's a really great sign. I thought the game against the Hawks was the full LeVert experience. Like, there were really, really important stretches where he was contributing to winning basketball, and then there were inexcusable stretches, like multiple shot clock violations. Like, it really was the full experience. I feel bad for him. Like, he echoed a lot of what we've been saying about not really getting the full opportunity. It was just such a weird year, changing teams, missing a month right away. Like, there are so many things that went into it. I'm not opposed to just letting him run it back. I don't know how keen I would be on an extension. But I definitely see a world where he comes in and maybe it's like almost like filling in the Jetty role off the bench, where, yeah, there's maybe some variance, but usually the lows aren't as low as what we saw with LeVert.
I would like to ask you to power rank the wings on this team and talk about who should be the minutes, the leading minutes getter, and who should be at the bottom between Caris, Isaac, Colin. And I'll leave it there. I'm not going to include Lowry just because I know he will get minutes at the four.
Here's the thing. I don't really want to do this because I want to see how the offseason development goes for these guys. But if I'm blind guessing, like, Colin would be pretty high on my list. Like,
Colin must be number one unless he is not healthy. That is what I was ramping up to.
Like, call him to me. That's the one where I feel like if he's coming back, and even if he's 85% of who he is to start the year and he needs to kind of play his way back into shape, that is still a massive boost for this offense. That is, like, the thing with Colin is, especially with him taking the route that has the fewest long-term concerns with the meniscus surgery, like, we already know that he can adjust his game for the good of the team. He went from being a mid-range scorer to someone that shoots threes. Now he's playing more off ball. He was playing better defense. Like, we know that this is a guy that's willing to sacrifice, that works hard, that fits the culture, really jump-started the culture change in Cleveland. To me, that's someone that gets prioritized. And Okoro had a real opportunity to step up this season. And I thought there were flashes with him, but I didn't see enough to kind of change my mind that Sexton is probably the best option at this point. That can certainly change. Growth isn't linear. He's going to have a real off season here.
Can I further make the case for Colin?
Go for it.
He also he solves for some of the things that lineup was missing. There were times where you're really hoping that Karras can just hit a three when you know it's not really his strength. Colin is a certified three-point shooter. Other than the first 10 games of this past year, funny enough.
Yeah. He's had cold stretches before. We've seen that, and yes, we've seen him pull out of it.
His off-ball activity, it really was showing development, so he doesn't have to be on the ball all the time. He was a killer back cutter to start the year, even while the rest of his game was kind of catching up. I think that I don't think that the undersized thing carries as much weight compared to Karras, just because I didn't really feel a huge impact from Karras's size in the minutes he played this year. It didn't feel like the Cavs had a lot more defensive options available to them just because he was out there. So I just think it makes a lot of sense to start leading with Colin. Obviously, letting camp play out. You don't decide these things right now, but as it currently stands, that's the case. The other thing that I think needs to be said is right now, Okoro is third on that list, which would mean that if Lowry remains at the three, he is your fourth wing. Mm-hmm. And I think that as much as I don't want to overreact to the small sample of the play-in, we also had a full year of Isaac not really developing offensively the way we wanted to see. And I do think next year is going to be a bit of a turning point year for him with his tenure with the Cavaliers, because it is just really, really hard to be this big of a project on offense when the team has legitimate aspirations to winning. The rest of this roster kind of sped up Isaac's development curve in a way that is a little unfair to the guy. He was meant to be a big really project. Is,
yeah. And like he's barely older than Mobley, right? Like exactly. Just a couple months older. Right.
And so like I think like ultimately it's gonna be an important offseason for him. This is the first real offseason that he's gonna have.
Yep.
5 months, man. It's gonna be crazy. It's so long till the next time we see this team play regular season basketball. And I think
what's in 1 month, Carter?
The draft, summer league? I don't remember.
The draft lottery.
Where
we get rewarded for all the bad karma, all the injuries. We are jumping up, baby. That's the karma payback. Can you imagine how mad everyone would be if the Cavs jumped up in this lottery?
Yeah, it would not be good vibes for anyone else. But I guess all this to say, I think that at a certain point, JB has to see it on offense. You have to feel Isaac a little more on offense. He's got to find something to hang his hat on, whether it's the jumper, whether it's an improved handle. I don't care, actually. I think they can accommodate a lot of roads to Isaac being an impactful offensive player. But
that's
they can't,
such a smart point.
But they can't accommodate none of them.
Yep.
Because Karras, as difficult, as frustrating as Karras is, early tenure with the Cavs was, and I think he probably would tell you it was frustrating, he still offers a better variety on the wing than what Isaac does against winning teams. I certainly wanted him out there against the Hawks, even though I thought he had a very up and down game compared to who else was available. And then Colin's put up 24 and 4 on efficient scoring. I mean, you can't
play Isaac over Khan. So all of a sudden, his opportunities are starting to shrink a little bit.
Yep, I think that's fair. I still think the nice thing is I do believe that there are things that he can build off of. Like, I think the stretch where he was shooting well from three, I think that that is something that you can look at. I think the
worst time for that right corner to abandon him, man.
Yeah.
That's like 3 months of perfect right corner shooting and then playing. Sucks. I feel bad for
that. I do think that there's things to build off with him. Like you look even tonight, Boston, Brooklyn. Marcus Smart is the Vegas leader to win Defensive Player of the Year. And he's playing great defense on Kyrie. But Kyrie goes out there and he still scores incredibly efficiently. That is what the best players will do. When you're a great defender, you can make those guys work, but ultimately the elite offensive players are still going to get theirs. Marcus Smart came in raw offensively, and he eventually progressively added things to the game. Playmaking, the three-point shooting. Okoro needs to go through that exact same kind of growth curve, and I'm not writing it off at all. By all accounts, like, he's one of the hardest workers out there. But at this point, like, I agree. Like, Sexton putting up 24-4 on efficient scoring is not something to sneeze at. Like, that is a very high variable option for the Cavs to have. And the Cavs haven't lost anybody that I can recall in the last couple decades that they wanted to keep. Like, if there's a player that they've preferred to keep, they've kept them. Like, the exceptions have been, like, Mozgov, who got paid too much and that looked bad immediately, or Dele, whose contract was so bad that the Bucks ended up giving a first-round pick that the Cavs turned into Jared Allen as a result of getting off that contract, right? Like, the Cavs haven't lost a guy that they valued. And I think the best way to kind of frame the Sexton situation is I don't think he can be your solution for this offseason, but I think he can be part of it. I think that is absolutely a 16-game player. I have been adamant over the years that we've done this podcast that he and Garland can work. I think there's even more likelihood that it works now that we know Allen and Mobley can work. I think you're going to have people that will question it the same way that they question Allen and Mobley of, okay, how can these guys two fit together? Do they play well off one another? Like, all of those questions are going to be there, but I think no matter what the role is, I think that there is a significant spot for what Sexton brings to this team. And my preference would be to bring him back. Maybe there's going to be opportunities that we can't foresee on the trade market, the free agent market,
sign
whatever the
trades,
case may be.
We don't know. But I certainly wouldn't do like one of those. Like, I would be disappointed if it were one of those sign and trades to just like get something for someone before they leave, you know, like the mm-hmm. the fake second and you know, Precious Achiuwa. Kind of, you know, like, I mean, and Precious has actually been pretty good for Toronto, so that's maybe not fair, but you get my point. Like, if Colin isn't on this team next year, I would be sad if it was just because they couldn't make the money work, because I just think he's earned a shot with the team. We saw the blueprint start to work a little bit, and we just felt his absence so much.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see him back.
Yeah, like I honestly feel like he's the fourth with this team. And from there, like I think his ceiling is higher. Like I think that it still can, he can improve from where he's at. I think he can be a real contributor. So that's obviously that we're going to discuss more of that as the offseason comes along. We have so much to talk about. There's so many interesting ways that this thing can go. I'm very excited to get into it already. I am a psychopath, but you know what? We'll save those for future podcasts. So for everyone that's tuning in live on YouTube, thank you so much for your support all season. You guys have meant so much to us. If you want to support the podcast, like, subscribe, click the notification bell so you know when we're going live. If you are listening via podcast, leave us a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help cook those books. If you want to be part of the Chasedown's exclusive Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. However you choose to support us, we really do appreciate it. Make sure you guys are staying safe out there. Until next time, go Cavs.
Good season, everybody. Love you. Bye.